and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very, very special guest. She's a New York Times bestselling author of over 16 novels of Inspector Lynley. And this new one is an Inspector Lynley. It's called This Body of Death, and she's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hello, nice to be here.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for letting me do this. It's such a privilege to talk to you. I'm a huge fan. I mean,
thank you.
I just love these books. I can still remember sitting in my garden reading one of your novels and enjoying it so much. The pleasure that I got out of that book on that day and reading that whole book, it just stays with me.
Well, you know, I think that's what good books are supposed to do. They open up a world to the reader. They introduce the reader to new characters and to new situations and one hopes new ideas as well. And for a book to resonate and then to remain with the reader afterwards, I think it's really the highest praise that one could really offer.
And how many books does that happen with when you read? You know, I read a lot of books, and some, you know, I remember while I'm reading it, and then I forget. The next day, I won't even remember much about it. But yours, there's such a, whether it's the psychological aspect of it or the characters that resonate. I mean, Inspector Lynley resonates with so many people. I mean, we feel, it's almost like when we're reading these books, we feel his pain along with him. He comes off the page and becomes this real person to us.
And, you know, I think that's really what I try to do with the books. You know, when I've created the world of these characters, one of the things that I committed myself to early on was to make the characters living, breathing human beings with their own, with conflicts, with problems, with desires and passions. And I really wanted the reader to be able to see them as real people and not as just cardboard characters, the way sometimes you do find in novels of this type.
How is it that you have such a grasp of how to do that, but not every author does?
Well, I do spend a lot of time creating my characters in advance. I think that really helps. The characters they exist before there is a word written on the page of the rough draft. So when I'm creating one of these novels, I begin with the crime, and then once I have an idea of what the crime is going to be, then I people the world of that crime first generically and then specifically. And in the peopling of that world, then what I'm doing is actually creating these characters in every way you could possibly think of, as far as their emotional background goes, their familial background, their psychological background, any kind of pathology they have. I mean, everything just has as complete a profile as I can work up. And then when I have the character ready to, you know, sort of make his debut on the page, I have a pretty good idea of how this character is going to behave. And they do stay fairly true to themselves right straight through the novel then.
Is it hard for you to think up this? I mean, let's take This Body of Death, a new one. Was this a difficult book for you to write, or does it come pretty easy for you?
I mean, no book comes easily. I have to say, I remember reading one time a writer talking about the books becoming more difficult over time, and I think that that's really very much the case. So, in particular, This Body of Death was a tough book for me. Because I all books are tough to plot. That's once I have the characters, that's one thing. And but getting the specific details of plot into the right place so that I'm not playing my hand too soon is a crucial step, and it's a really tough step that has never gotten any easier for me.
Is it fun though doing it? I mean, do you always have fun writing, or is it sometimes overwhelming work?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at how we define fun. For me, my career as a professional writer doesn't need to be fun. I think you could also say, is a brain surgeon having fun?
Yeah.
It opens up somebody's skull.
That's a point. Yes.
For me, it's really important that the work be challenging and ultimately satisfying. but it is not the least bit important for me to have fun. Now, that said, do I have to drag myself to my office every day and work? Absolutely not. It is a great joy to me to do that. I feel very privileged that I am able to do it and to support myself doing it, but I would never call it fun. When I think of fun, I think of skiing or boogie boarding or riding roller coasters. You know, it's that sort of fun, wahoo kind of excitement thing, but I definitely don't think of riding in those terms.
Do you ever have trouble coming up with an idea? I mean, is it ever?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And what do you do when that happens?
The point at which I have trouble with an idea is in the beginning stages, when I am really thinking of what is going to actually drive the plot of this novel. What is my, what's my crime going to be? Is it going to be a crime at all? What's its nature? Who's involved? What makes this different from other crimes? Oops, there go my dogs.
That's okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
For me, that's the most difficult part. And sometimes I go over to England to do the preliminary research and don't even have any idea of what the crime is going to be. And that's, I call that, high risk researching. That's what happened to me in the book I'm working on right now. I went to Cumbria to do the research on it and literally had absolutely no idea what I was going to do. And it was very, very, it's real scary, to tell you the truth.
And that's going
to
be, that'll be the 17th, Inspector Lindley,
yeah,
when you're working?
Yeah, that's the next book.
Oh, what a thrill. Just hearing about it, I get goosebumps, you know? Because I just can't, I mean, you have to understand as a reader, maybe you do, I'm sure you have authors that you can't wait to see their next book. You can't wait to get it in your hands and read it. I mean,
Sure, absolutely.
And your books are exactly like that. I've never read a book by you that I have not enjoyed thoroughly.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
That has never happened to me, and I don't think it ever will, because I just like the way you write. I like the feeling of reading this book and feeling like I'm there, and when Lindley's walking along the rocks, and I feel like I'm walking along with him. It's just an amazing feeling. And
well, one of the things that I try to do is to give the reader a big sense of place, because those kind of books were always really important to me. I loved reading books where I really got a sense of where the book took place. Things that come to mind immediately are Martin Cruz Smith's books.
Right, yes.
Anna Bay did that. His wonderful, wonderful book that I think got very little attention, Rose, was just an amazing turn, creating the industrial revolution town of Wigan. But it was just a living, breathing place. And place is such an important part of a crime novel, because it ultimately, well, first of all, it gives so much to atmosphere, but ultimately it can function as another character in the book as well.
Right. And this book is based on the real Bulger case that happened in 1993. Is that correct?
Well, it is and it isn't. That obviously is my jumping off point.
Right.
Although there are, significant things that are different, but the main idea of these 10-year-old boys kidnapping or basically walking off with I think in my book he's 18 months old, or he might be 2 years old, and I think James Bulger was 2 years old. So that part of it is similar. I have three boys instead of two boys.
Right.
And the nature of the crime is slightly different, but the main thing, that main idea of children committing a horrific act beyond all imagination is the same, as is the reality of the prosecution and the sentencing. That is pretty much identical to what happened in court. So the full details of the Bulger murder were never revealed, because his parents were in the courtroom, and the peculiar method of sentencing was the same too, where they just couldn't decide what they were going to do with these.
Have you ever based any of the other ones on a real life case like that? I mean, or have little elements of it? Has that ever happened with you before? I don't remember one.
I would have to really, you know, to think back and to consider it. No, I mean, there's been odd serendipity involved in some of my books, in that when I was going over to do the research for In the Presence of the Enemy, which involved the...
I love that one.
That's one of my favorite books. It involved a member of parliament, the kidnapping and death of the illegitimate child of a member of parliament. When I was on the plane going over to do research for this book, a member of parliament had just been outed for having an affair and an illegitimate child. It was just the most amazing thing. And I had to do virtually no research for it other than to pick up the newspaper every day and watch how it played out in the newspaper. It was just remarkable.
That is remarkable. And that's one of my favorites. I just remember, especially the shocker ending in that book is something that I will always remember.
I love, there are certain moments in that book that I particularly love. One is when Linley has Havers on the phone and tells her who the killer is. And she's in Wiltshire and he's in London.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
I love that moment. And I also love the moment where St. James is has gotten hold of his tape recorder. And the kidnapper has made a tape on the tape recorder, and he dusts it for fingerprints, and there are no fingerprints on the tape recorder itself. And then he takes out the cassette, and there are no fingerprints on the cassette. And then he flips open the back and takes out the batteries and dusts them and looks up and says, "No one thinks of everything." And I just loved that moment where it sort of gave me chills when I wrote it. Because as I was writing it, I didn't know if he was going to find fingerprints or not. I was just writing it, and all of a sudden I went, oh, my God, of course. This is where he finds the fingerprint.
You may, and see, just listening to you say that and how much you must have really enjoyed that part, knowing that you had it exactly the way it should be. And it,
yes, that's a great moment. Now, that's a moment of fun. It's more a moment of glee, where
right.
All of a sudden you see that here is something, it's like clicking right into place, and I didn't know it was going to do that. That's a great feeling.
Right.
And I think it sort of comes out of doing a lot of groundwork in the beginning, laying a really good foundation so that the pieces are always there for the writer to pick up, but it's the recognizing the pieces and picking them up in the right order that's the real challenge.
And the amazing thing is, your books are all, this one's 689 pages. It's a long book, but it never seems that way to me when I'm reading it. It's just an enjoyable read for me. Do your fans ever complain about the length of your books?
No, they never do. The only time anybody has ever complained, it's been a critic, probably because they have to read it all.
Right, exactly.
Although sometimes when you read the review, you realize the critic didn't
right.
didn't read anything more than the dust jacket. But no, I've actually never had a fan say that. Actually, most of the time, what readers say is exactly what you said, and that is, oh my God, this book was 650 pages long. I can't believe it. I read it in 2 days, or whatever. But I always explain to them that part of it has to do with the metric quality of the writing, which is quite deliberate on my part. You see, my editor told me a long time ago, sort of jokingly, no one will ever accuse you of writing a fast-paced novel. And that's really true. My books are not, they're not fast-paced. Then the question is, why is it that people seem to be able to just, like, breeze right through them? And that has to do with two things. First of all, it has to do with the way each paragraph is constructed, because individual sentences are constructed with a particular metric flow to them,
right.
So that one sentence leads ineluctably to the next sentence, and then that paragraph is joined to the next paragraph, usually through some specific kind of language. So what happens is that the reader ends up becoming propelled through the narrative without even realizing it's happening to them. So they're reading what's actually not a very fast-paced novel, but it moves quickly because of the language.
Right. Now, you were an English teacher. So, did you know while you were an English teacher that you were going to write at some point? Did you know that was going to happen, or did you just decide one day to start writing? What happened?
Well, it would be best to put it this way: that I, while I was teaching, I knew I was supposed to be writing, and I avoided it for a long time.
Why?
I didn't have a lot of confidence in my ability to first of all, to carry off a story. I didn't have a lot of, I didn't know what I was going to write. And actually, until I started teaching this class called the mystery novel or the mystery story at El Toro High School, I wasn't quite sure, you know, if I had anything to write, except that I really loved the written word, and I would play with it during the summer. I would create stories, create screenplays, create poetry, whatever. But when I taught this course, I began to see that this was a distinct possibility for me to enter this particular world and to use this particular type of novel as a vehicle instead of seeing it as sort of the end-all and be-all, you know, the detectives march hand-in-hand to solve a crime. Well, I could use the crime as a skeleton upon which I could hang great elements of fiction, great numbers of fundamentals of fiction. In other words, I could explore theme, I could explore character, I could create, you know, literary symbols and life symbols and metaphors and all kinds of stuff. The one requirement would be that there would be a crime, and during the course of the novel, the investigators would solve that crime. But as long as they did that, then anything else could go into the book as well. And that's how I always looked at it.
And the interspersement of the crime, the other crime, the one that's based on the real crime, the way it starts out like that, and it's so interesting the way you suddenly start to realize why is she telling us so much about this other thing, and how is it going to relate to the story? And the way it weaves into the story is just fascinating.
Oh, sure. And for me, the challenge in that was to create this voice of the person who's writing this report. You know, to create this dispassionate, clinical voice. Person is there to explain this ultimately, as it turns out, for this European Commission child punishment, juvenile justice, basically, is what she's writing it for. But the reader doesn't realize that until the end of the book. But creating that voice of the sociologist was a unique challenge for me, since it was not my voice.
And it's interesting, the PBS programs they did with about Lindley and Havers, are they're equally as good I love to watch them. I absolutely enjoy, and so much, I think I've seen every one. I can't get enough of those two. And I know that a lot of people feel that maybe they're not as close, they're not like they remember them looking in the book, you know. But do you feel they're anywhere close to how they should be?
Well, physically, of course, neither one of them
Right. Looks
anything like Lindley and Havers from the novels. But I always tell readers who complain about that my Lindley is probably not the same as their Lindley, and their Lindley is probably not the same as the Lindley of the person sitting next to them. That everybody takes into the reading experience their own visual of what the characters are like.
What was your reaction when you first saw one? How did you feel?
I knew who all the actors were, of course, and I had met them on the set. I had seen Sharon Small in other things on British television, and I had also seen Nathaniel Parker. My main concern was Sharon, in that she's very pretty, and I didn't see how she was going to be able to do Havers. But once I saw her performance, and I was fortunate enough to see it in person, she was doing the scene from A Great Deliverance, where she tells Lindley about what she had done to her own parents. And when I saw her do that scene, I knew that she was the perfect Havers, and that I wouldn't have had anybody else play the role. I think that she was just a jewel as Havers.
Now, if we gave you a pen or a pencil or whatever, would you be able to draw what they look like?
Oh, God, no. I mean, no. I can close my eyes and see what they look like, but I certainly couldn't draw what they look like.
But in your mind, you know how they look, it sounds like.
Oh, yes, I know exactly how they look in my mind, yeah.
So seeing that they're so different in the TV, it must be a little startling at first. And then, like you said, because they can act so well, and they do, they're fine actors.
And you know what I was very concerned with in having them translated into film, as far as my own work went, was whether their performances and their physicality would get in the way of my ability to write Lindley and Havers as I always had seen them. And I say that because when I first listened to one of the audio tapes I had to stop listening. I wasn't able to finish it because the audio tape got in the way so much with my ability to hear the characters' voices. So I was very concerned whether this might happen with the film as well, but it didn't at all. I found that, you know, their Linley and Havers was their Linley and Havers, and my Linley and Havers remained my Linley and Havers, and it was not a problem.
And it's interesting, Inspector Linley, from what's happened in the past, and I don't want to give anything away, but he's a very changed person now, and he's never going to be the same again.
Right.
And it's quite interesting to read that. You think, well, what would I feel like if I went through what he went through, losing somebody you love so much? I mean, how would you feel about that? And you do such a great job of that despair coming off the page. You know, you just feel like you just feel so bad for him going through what he's been through, and he's still in this book, This Body of Death. He's still suffering from that.
Oh, sure, because it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been that long. In This Body of Death, it's July, and his wife died in February. So, although it's been a number of years in the lives of the readers, it hasn't been that long in his life. So you always have to keep that in mind, that their time moves much more slowly in the novels. Otherwise, Linley would already be, you know,
And we introduced Isabel in this book. Isabel Ardery is her name. And she is quite the interesting person. She's his new boss. And
yes, well, she was a character that had a very minor role in a book called Playing for the Ashes.
Oh, I must have forgotten. Oh, it's been a while since.
Arson investigator. She only has a cameo, and it's when Linley and Havers first get out to Kent. She's there, and I think she's actually on the phone with her ex-husband at that time. And Havers takes note of her immediately because she is this sort of statuesque, attractive woman. And in Playing for the Ashes, Linley and Helen are sort of undecided about what their, well, let's say Helen is undecided about what her future with Linley actually is. And Havers is a great advocate of Helen, and she's immediately suspicious when there's this good-looking woman who comes into Linley's, his sphere. But I quite liked the character, and when it came time to decide who was going to replace Linley as acting detective superintendent and ultimately step into the role of detective superintendent full-time, I decided to bring this character back and see how she played. And she had been, I dug out her old character analysis from the file on Playing for the Ashes and read it through and thought, yeah, I think she's going to be right on the money.
How wonderful.
So she came back for another go-round with the characters, and I think she held her own pretty well with them.
And that's another great thing. I mean, I can see scenes from Playing with the Ashes in my mind, even today. As long as it's been since I read that book, I can see them in my mind, some of the things that happened. I mean, and what a compliment to you that you have so pictured, so told that story so vividly that I can remember those scenes. I can remember the end scenes of that book.
Well, that's I so much appreciate that because the thing about these novels is that I don't bang them out.
Right.
They are the result of a whole lot of time and effort and
You're not a once a year author, that's for sure.
No, and I always tell my writing students that that I suit up and show up. I mean, that's really what it's all about, is the willingness to be there for the work day after day.
Absolutely. And we as readers certainly appreciate it. I mean, nobody wants to read a book that isn't going to be enjoyable. And and if you're writing a book a year, sometimes it gets stale. You know, you don't have that freshness of taking the time and making sure it sounds just right.
Yeah.
And rushing through it. I mean, there's so much with quantity now, the writers putting out so many different books. I mean, Nora Roberts has 150 some books. I mean, it's like,
oh.
I mean, it's like, how do you do that? How do you make each one sound that good? I mean, to me, I don't know how you can write two or three a year. And and it's just, and while I applaud her for the effort, and I'm sure she works very hard, I don't take that away from her. They just don't have the feel that I want to read in a book. I want to read something like yours, something that's thought out, something that's intelligent, something that is thrilling, something that is interesting. And that's what I always get from you. And I count on that. And I never get let down.
Well, thank you. I hope I continue to live up to my previous standards. I'm trying, I'm sure.
How much do you get to read yourself? I mean, do you ever get to sit and read a book, or are you just
so
busy?
Sure, I do. I read twice a day. First in the morning when I'm doing my, I'm either on the exercise cycle or on the treadmill, and that gives me a half an hour of reading. And then just before I go to bed, I also read. So I move from one book to the next, to the next, to the next that way. And I'm never without a book. I can't really remember any time in my life when I've been out without a book, a novel. Possibly when I was in university, maybe might have been a time, but most of the time I have had books with me, and I've always been reading, and I still do that. I always try to read up. You know, I always want to read something that's better than what it is that I'm writing, or better than I think I am. Always.
Right. Interesting. It's interesting because every writer has a different perspective on that. I read myself every night before I go to bed. I never don't have a book with me to read.
And
there's something wonderful about that. There's just something. But how many hours a day can you write? Do you have a certain set number of hours, or is it just whatever comes out?
Well, I write I write to a specific amount of work each day, and it depends on what part of the novel I am doing. So, for example, right now I'm working on part of the rough draft. So when I'm working on part of the rough draft, I write a minimum of 5 pages a day. When I'm doing the...
Is that 7 days a week you do that?
That's 5 days a week.
That's
5 days a week always, whether I'm here, whether I'm in England, whether I'm on vacation, you know, whatever. The first thing I do is write those 5 pages. So that allows me to always to stay present in the story. I can't go away for 2 weeks and take a trip to Europe and then come back and expect to still be present in the story. It's way too difficult. I learned that over time because I used to do that. Then I'd come home and have to read the whole novel from the beginning to figure out where the heck I was. So now what I do is I just get up early and do the work and then go about whatever it is that I had planned for my vacation that day.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
If I'm doing a different part, like if I'm doing the running plot outline, I try to do 3 scenes each day. And that's actually the creation of the scene in sort of a stream of consciousness, present tense format that sort of shows me how that scene is going to be shaped, what it's what my entry point is going to be, what my exit point is going to be, whose point of view it's going to be from, what it is I'm trying to accomplish in this scene, and how it's going to propel things forward in the book. And so when I'm at that section of it, I do 3 of those a day. So it just really depends on what I'm doing. If I'm doing characters, I do 2 characters a day.
You have just mastered this art of writing. To me, you are a master, because I don't know who that I've read is better than you as far as mysteries
I came up with a process. Part of it was, for some writers, everybody has a process, and everyone's process is different. For me, my process has a lot to do with the fact that I suffer from what I call A student syndrome. In other words, I'm a perfectionist. I want to get an A on my paper. So for me to send a book into my editor and then get, as I did on my first novel, quite innocently, a 9-page letter, which was my revision letter, with 27 paragraphs that had nothing but questions in them that I had to figure out a way to answer. Well, do that once and you're not going to make that mistake again. So I thought, well, I don't want to be doing this. This isn't the way I want to approach my writing. So I had to figure out a process that would each time turn in a better book, more close to perfect, so that I would have less and less work to do on revision, because I hate revisions. I don't mind revising based on my own editorial letter to myself, but I don't like revising based on my editor's letter to me. It's not because I think I know better. It's because by the time I give it to my editor, I am so done with the work. I don't want to have to do any more work on it because I've really, really put out this tremendous effort. Usually my editor never sees anything before my third draft. So you can imagine at the third draft point, if the editor then sends me a letter saying, well, we ought to do this.
Right.
I'm thinking, oh, God, please, no. But,
now,
but luckily that very rarely happens because I've really worked the heck out of the thing before she ever sees it.
There's so many questions I want to ask you. I'm just thrilled to be able to talk to you, and I feel like I don't know where to go next. But I wanted to ask about Linley. Do we know everything there is to know about Linley, or will there be other things that be revealed about Linley that we don't know yet?
You mean in his psyche or in his life, or
both?
Well, I would say that there's definitely more to be revealed in his life. I mean, I know where his life is heading for sure, and I've known that for quite some time. But there's more there to be revealed about him and about Havers and about St. James and Deborah. Indeed, yeah.
Do your books sell better here or over in England?
Well, you have to remember that our populations are so different in size.
Right.
So it would really be hard for me to make a comparison there. You know, they're bestsellers here, they're bestsellers there, but who knows what that means. My biggest audience is most curiously, is Germany.
Germany?
Yeah. And there have been, various opinions offered as to why this is the case. I don't know why, but they have been extremely popular in Germany from the very beginning.
Wow, I wonder why Germany. I'm very curious. I'd love to speak to
it. Well, one time, one person said, one of us, a German journalist, said, it's because you say about the British what they're unwilling to say about themselves. I don't think that's the case.
Do you have hobbies? I mean, on a day when you're not working, what would we catch you doing? I mean, do you do any kind of needlepoint sewing? Do you do gardening or?
Well, this afternoon, what you would have caught me doing was, it's going to sound very funny, this will give you an idea of how truly compulsive I am. You would have found me weeding in the forest. I live up on Whidbey Island in Washington,
yes.
And now that spring appears to be finally with us. In mid-May, what's happening is that the weeds are rampant, and so in order to be able to keep the forest a walkable forest, you have to get out there and clip the blackberries one by one and spray them with with weed killer, and do the same with the creepers, and then pull out all this wide variety of weeds that thrive. Thrive up here. I wouldn't call that so much a hobby, though. It is really a necessity. But you know what? It's really wonderful because it gets me out of the house, and it's quiet out in the forest, and I can hear the interesting noises that the eagles make. They make the most bizarre sound. We have bald eagles that are nesting in one of the big Douglas firs. I think it's a Douglas fir. That is on the edge of our, on the bluff above Saratoga Passage where I live. And that's pretty neat to see that. It's really neat when all of a sudden you hear the tapping of the woodpeckers and realize that here you are out in the middle of nature all of a sudden. So it's really delightful. But other than that, I would say, hobby-wise, I'm more of a craft kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I do two crafts when I have the time. One is decorative scrapbooking. And I make, scrapbooks that are usually commemorating some event. And they're a combination of photographs and decorative pages together. And I don't do very much writing. Somebody once said to me, oh, but you're supposed to journal in these two. And I said, believe me, after I'm done with my writing for the day, I am not about to journal in some scrapbook.
I think we can forgive you for that, yes.
But I do. I do that. And then I also do this thing that's called mixed media mosaics. And I learned it from an artist in Laguna Beach, California. And essentially what it is it's making a mosaic on a tray of some kind, an old silver tray, making a mosaic out of found objects. And I really enjoy doing that. It's totally different from writing. This is completely different.
Well, you're just very artistic.
And then the last thing I can actually is that I study Italian.
Now, will you be at the BelgerCon coming up in October? Is it
San Francisco? No, I won't. I think I will probably be in Italy again.
I never get to see you at the BelgerCon, and I've always wanted to meet you. I've never had the pleasure of meeting you, and it's frustrating.
Well, I almost went to the BelgerCon last year, I think it was, but what happened is that I was really, really up against the wall because I was very dissatisfied with the placement of the sociologist report in this body of death.
Right.
So I kept tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it, and finally I was right up against the wall with my deadline, and I hate to miss a deadline. That's part of the whole A student thing.
Right.
So I had to cancel on the BelgerCon so that I could meet my deadline, and I did meet. I got the book there on the day it was due, so I was very pleased with that.
That's wonderful. And what a book you produced. I mean, This Body of Death, it's now in the New York Times. I don't know what number it is, but I know it's on the list right now, and it's doing fantastic, and it's just a wonderful book. And now, knowing that, I think, well, I guess it was worth the sacrifice. But I'm sure if you went to these things, you'd have a crowd waiting for you, because you have a very loyal following.
Well, I so much appreciate that, too. You know, I am completely aware of the importance of the reader and the whole triumvirate that exists but among reader, writer, and work. You know, without the reader, there's really no point to anything. So I am extremely grateful for the support that readers have shown me throughout the years.
And you know, it's interesting because working in a bookstore like I do, the customers come in, they can't wait for the next book, and it's like you see that look on their face, like they're disappointed, and they leave, and they don't have the new book, and they have to wait. You tell them it's going to be a year, it's going to be whatever, and it's the poor readers are the ones that suffer because they just can't stop reading the series, and this is one of those series that you just can't get enough of.
But one thing that's nice about the books, I think, is that they hold up to a second reading. I think the stories are complicated enough that the reader can go back for a second time and see things that they didn't see at all the first time. You know, For the Sake of Elena is a great example of that. And For the Sake of Elena, it's always there.
Right.
The truth is always there. But people generally don't see it. And then when they read it the second time, they go, oh my God, there it was.
Like the Sixth Sense, that movie, The Sixth Sense. When you read it, when you watch it the second time, everything falls into place. You see what you should have seen the first time.
Exactly.
And it is just—it's an amazing experience, and that's what makes movies and books so wonderful. When you can read them a second time and see things you didn't see before.
Yes.
Especially, and there's so many books to read. I mean, I just found myself going through them so quickly, and then you end up missing things, and then people will tell me and remind me of things, and I'm like, oh, I've forgotten about that moment. How long does it take you normally to read a book? Say it's a 400-page book. Are you a fast reader?
I'm probably a medium reader because I'm only, you know, I only have a certain amount of time each day to read. That slows me down a little bit. On the other hand, if I, you know, have a plane flight to take, then that will speed up my process because it gives me some uninterrupted time just to sit and read. So I would just say medium. I'm not really particularly fast. I'm not slow, though.
How often do you get to England to do research?
Well, when I lived in Southern California, I went over as often as I could because I was never very happy in Southern California. I'm not a Southern California kind of girl.
Right.
So I would go over, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a year. I had a flat in London, and that made it really easy. I didn't have to worry about where I was going to stay. But when we moved to the Pacific Northwest, I find myself in a place that is so beautiful, and for me, beautiful at all seasons. Where some people are very, very depressed in the autumn and winter, but I don't find that the gray depressing at all. So it's much more difficult to leave now. So now I tend to go over only when I am actually doing the research for a book. I probably should get over a little bit more often so that I remain current with what's going on. As a matter of fact, today I found myself feeling a little bit nostalgic that I missed out on being in England when Gordon Brown resigned.
Right.
Because it was, you know, those kinds of things are so fascinating. I was in England, for example, when Tony Blair first became prime minister all those years ago.
Oh, wow. That's great. Can we expect a book next year?
Next year?
Yes, from you?
No. I will be, it'll probably be, God willing, it'll be in production by then.
Right.
I'm about a little over 500 pages
right.
into the book that I'm working on right now. But it's the rough draft, and I know as I'm writing it that this is going to be at least probably two full drafts before I send it to my my cold reader down in Southern California. And then that means another draft after that, at least one other draft after that.
So we're looking at 2012 then, probably?
Yeah, that would probably be the soonest that it's
I can't wait. I wish it were 2012 right now. I really feel, you know, I say that and we joke and we can laugh about that, but I really feel that way. I really feel like I can't wait to read this thing. And, you know, and that's great for me to feel that way, but it's also this, oh, and the more you talk about it, the more excited I get about it.
Well, I think that what you have to do then is, you know, is to start back at the beginning and read the whole series.
Exactly.
One thing, actually, that provides readers with is a chance to see how I've grown, one hopes, as a writer. Because the later books, I think, are a richer and more complex story than the earliest books were.
Now, do you get to pick your covers on your books at all? Do you get a say in what gets put on the cover?
Well, yeah, I have cover approval, but I leave most of that to the the people who know what a cover ought to look like and what a cover ought to do.
Right.
So essentially, when my publisher sends me the cover, I always say the same thing. I say, as soon as Robert tells me what I think, I'll let you know. Robert's my literary agent, and because I don't really know what a cover should look like, and how really. I know what appeals to me, but actually British covers tend to appeal to me more.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that, yes.
Than American covers. But I don't necessarily mean my British covers. I just mean British covers in general.
Right, absolutely.
Tend to appeal to me more. I find myself in the bookstores in England much more drawn to books than I am here. But why is that? I don't know, really.
I agree with you totally. I saw your British cover for This Body of Death, and I just was blown away. I thought, wow, that's really a cool cover. There's just something about them that really... just really grabs you. I don't know what it is. I mean, but it's just something there. If you had to pick some mystery authors that you get really excited about, like I get excited about you today, who would you say?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, the mystery writer that I like the best is somebody who's pretty hard to find in the United States, and that is a woman called J. Wallace Martin.
Huh.
I have really, really liked her books a lot, and I got to meet her a few years ago in Manchester, and she's a tremendous writer and wonderful, wonderful books, but little known in the United States.
No, I've never heard of her. Now I'm.
Yeah, initial J and then Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S. Martin. I don't know if she's published here, to tell you the truth.
Well, I'm going to check into her. Is there anybody else that comes to mind without hurting anybody's feelings? I don't want to make you choose, but it.
Well, you know, there are certain people that I read for certain reasons. You know, for example, I always enjoy reading Robert Crace's books.
Right.
But one of the reasons is that I followed him right from the very beginning. We were pups together at Bantam, and he was published just the year before I was published. That's when Monkey's Raincoat came out. And I just absolutely loved Monkey's Raincoat. I just thought it was wonderful. And as I said to him later, oh my God, I thought you were going to kill off Joe Pike. And he said, I was, but then I realized I created this great character and I couldn't kill him.
And I have a woman that I work with who's totally excited about the Joe Pike novels. And I think the new ones of Joe Pike. And she says, he's my favorite. I like him yeah. better than Lee Child. You know, it's like
yeah, I think he's a wonderful writer. I enjoy the books of T. Jefferson Parker, whom I also
know. Absolutely. The Blue Hour, I think, is a masterpiece.
I think he's done some really, really wonderful work. And I've always said to him, you know, he can make Orange County look like an interesting place. That to me is just remarkable.
Absolutely. So reading is much fun for you as writing, as it sounds like.
Oh yeah! Oh heavens, yes! Oh gosh, I as I said to you earlier, I've never been without a book. I absolutely love it, and I can't understand how some people, don't read.
Right.
People who would say, "I don't remember the last book I read," or "When I can't remember reading a book," or, you know, I mean, I just can't even believe that.
And why don't more men read? I've never been able to figure that out.
I don't know. My husband is a great reader too. He reads a lot more slowly than I do. I think he likes to really stop, pause, picture, go back. He makes lists.
Right.
Remember who everybody is. You know, things like that. But I don't know why.
Is there something that you haven't done in your life that you'd like to do?
Well, I'm sure there is. Off the top of my head, there is, and I hope I get to do it. I really would like to go down to a little town in Basilicata in Italy, a little town called Tricarico, which is where my mother's family is from. I would really like to look up the rest of my relatives who are in Italy. And that's one of the reasons I've been studying Italian for 4 years now.
That's wonderful. I hope you get to do that. I'm sure you will.
Yeah, I think I will.
You're a very determined lady. I can hear it in your voice. I can see you doing that very, very soon. Well, I know, I'm sure you know this, but I just want you to know how much your books really mean to me. I mean,
thank you.
They just mean everything to me. And for the best mysteries, I go to you. And, you know, that'll never change. Because I know I trust you, and I know that every book's going to be quality. And that means a lot to me, and it means a lot to a lot of your readers.
Well, I'm, you know, it's my commitment to them,
right?
And my commitment to the process. And I have to apologize for my dog. I was standing over her all this time, holding a bottle of spray, which is why she was quiet. And I just walked off, and she's just like taking that opportunity because she was chewing on something.
Right. How many dogs do you have?
I only have two. It sounds like I have 15.
Right. Is one of them the ones that's on the website that we see on the website?
Yeah, that's barking right now.
Right. Oh, that's great.
We call that exercising her right to barkulate.
Are you near the beach?
Well, no, we're not. We're on, you know, on Puget Sound.
Right.
Which certainly has beaches, but
right.
not ocean beaches.
I remember when I saw you were featured in People magazine one year, and you were on the beach.
That was when I lived in Huntington Beach.
Okay, so you were near the beach then. So that's great. It sounds like you have a really good life. You've worked so hard to get where you are right now, to be as far as I'm concerned the best, and. You know, and that's got to be very fulfilling.
You know, it is fulfilling, and what it is is a lot of hard work. But you know, I was sort of born lucky in that I was born with my mother's personality, and we were never afraid of hard work. So that's never been a problem for me.
And,
getting in there and doing what needs to be done.
And it shows, and it's just a joy to read you. Well, we've just about run out of time. This has been wonderful. I can't thank you enough. You're just a delightful lady.
Well, thank you so much, and I have to apologize for my dog's barking. It's sort of like life at my house.
Apology accepted. No problem at all.
Cute. So anybody who listens to this should just look on my website, and at least they can see what the dogs look like.
And absolutely. And the one that you see on the website is very cute.
Yes,
it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Certainly.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.